Hello, and welcome to this week's Talking History. My name is Robert Hopkins of Creighton University's Department of History, sitting in for Brian Lebeau. Looking back at this week, February 23rd through March 1st in history, we recall that on 23 February 1836, the siege of the Alamo began. The 10-day standoff in San Antonio, Texas, pitted a 3,000-man regiment of the Mexican Army against a group of 187 U.S. citizens who wanted Mexico to cede its claim to Texas. Only five Americans survived. On the 25th of February, 1913, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution was put into effect, granting Congress authority to levy taxes without approval from the states. On the 28th of February, 1854, a group of 50 opponents of slavery gathered in Ripon, Wisconsin. Their group would later form the Republican Party. And on 1 March, 1932, Charles and Ann Lindbergh discovered that their 19-month-old son, Charles Jr., had been kidnapped. 2 months later, the child's remains were discovered. Bruno Hauptmann was convicted and executed for the crime. And turning to history in the news, a precious piece of Civil War naval history sunken off the coast of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, may soon be raised. The Monitor, one of history's most celebrated warships, has recently become the focus of a federally funded rescue mission aimed at salvaging the wrecked ironclad vessel. By the time it sunk in 1862, the Monitor had changed the course of naval history, marking the end of the giant wooden fighting vessels and the beginning of armored battleships. While the ghost of a Civil War battleship rises from the sea, the angel of the battlefield has appeared in Washington, D.C. Boxes of files dating from 1868 and belonging to Miss Clara Barton were recently discovered amid the ruins of a dilapidated office building. The files contain detailed records of the federal government's attempt to locate Union soldiers who were missing in action at the war's end. Barton, a famous nurse in the Civil War, was charged with running the investigation and closing out the files of those men who could not be located. Barton later founded the Red Cross. And finally, the torn and tattered flag that inspired the Star-Spangled Banner will soon be cleaned and refurbished. The giant flag, measuring over 1,020 square feet and weighing over 150 pounds, will be removed from its current display in the Smithsonian and brought to the museum's specially designed refurbishing lab. There, in view of visitors, a team of restoration specialists will mend and reinforce the banner. The undertaking marks one of the most extensive textile restoration efforts in history and will cost an estimated $18.2 million. For our principal segment today, we're pleased to introduce to our listeners Dennis Mihalik, also of Creighton's Department of History, who will be interviewing historian Frank Schubert on America's famed Buffalo Soldiers. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you, Robert. Our guest today is Dr. Frank Schubert, a graduate of Howard University, who then completed his PhD studies at the University of Toledo. Currently, he is a historian at the Joint History Office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon. He is the author of three books on the Buffalo Soldiers, the famed African-American troops that were organized as segregated units led by white commissioned officers who were stationed in the American West during the era between the Civil War and World War I. Today, we will discuss his latest book, Black Valor, Buffalo Soldiers and the Medal of Honor, published by Scholarly Resources. Welcome, Dr. Schubert.
Thank you, Dennis. Great to be here.
The first chapter of your book is entitled Two Traditions, the Medal of Honor and Black Valor. Would you explain the origin of the Medal of Honor and how it acquired the exalted position as the most prestigious reward for gallantry in action?
Be happy to, or I'll summarize it for you. It came out of the Civil War when the medal was intended to recognize gallantry in action and other soldier-like qualities. And at the time, it was one of only two ways the Army recognized such actions, either through the medal or through the Certificate of Merit. And it was over the next half century that it evolved to the apex of what we call the Pyramid of Honor, with other decorations below it for lesser actions. But in the period we're talking about with the Buffalo Soldiers, it's an evolutionary period during which the medal is becoming the most significant decoration. But for most of it, it's the only decoration.
Okay, thank you. The second of your two traditions is Black Valor. How would you characterize the role African Americans have played in the military history of the United States?
Well, overall, I'd say that we're dealing with the movement of Black Americans from the margin to the mainstream in terms of their acceptance in the military establishment. However, having said that, all of their participation, whether it's been on the edge, marginalized and segregated units or not, it's always been involvement in major American processes and major events. What they have done has not been marginal in terms of where they have served or what activities they've participated in. It's just that they haven't had the opportunity to enter the mainstream, to become commission officers, to become general and flag officers.
Mm-hmm. How many Buffalo Soldiers were there, and what types of service did they do?
It's hard to say how many there were without getting out 50 years' worth of muster rolls and doing some very serious bean counting. But my estimate is that there were about 25,000 of them in the half century between the Civil War and World War I. As far as their activities are concerned, as I earlier mentioned, they were participating in major mainstream processes. So they were involved in creating infrastructure. They built roads. They strung telegraph wires. They were involved in bringing order to the frontier. They were involved in fighting Indians. They were involved against robbers. They were doing what other soldiers were doing, basically.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were. Am I correct that there were two infantry and two cavalry units?
You're absolutely correct. And I guess I should note, before we go a whole lot further, that the reason why there were these four regiments, the 9th and 10th Cavalry, the 24th and 25th Infantry, is because there had been 180,000 black soldiers in the Civil War. And their contribution to the Union victory was so significant that it couldn't be ignored. And those segregated black regiments, which became the Buffalo Soldiers, were established because of that contribution to Union victory.
Okay.
I think that's a real important, because that's where it all starts.
Yes. Okay, so then in general, they're serving in the American West in the late 19th century, which already was a multicultural society.
Well, this is a sensitive area for a lot of people, and I think we ought to start when we talk about multiculturalism in the West and a multiracial society. I think we ought to start from an article that Simon Sharma recently wrote in The New Yorker, in which he talked about a respect for the strangeness of the past. And he kind of warned us not to go back to the past with our current expectations and our current values and expect to see them validated or reflected. Now, the way I comprehend the frontier West, I see a multiracial European society, that is, one that spoke European languages and one that was literate and one that was an agrarian industrial society. I also see a multi-tribal society with which it was in conflict. And the soldiers operated out of that European multiracial society and confronted Indians. Now, this is where we come to the sensitive area, because there is an expectation today that one non-white group would look at another non-white group and understand and develop mutual empathy based on the fact that they were both oppressed by the white group. And this just didn't happen. Now, it happens in current fiction, it happens in current movies, but when the Buffalo Soldier confronted the Indian and the Indian confronted the Buffalo Soldier, they looked at each other across a cultural chasm as enemies. I think this is very important. I think it's very difficult for some people to understand. But the Buffalo Soldier tended to adapt the attitudes of the majority, which is basically the European culture they came from.
And in your rendition of the different vignettes in your book, you bring out interesting specific episodes in which, for example, the white population around an army post did not except the black soldiers.
No, they didn't. White racism is a fact on the frontier. If we focus too much on how blacks and Indians interacted, we miss one of the major elements of the frontier equation, and that's white racism. And there's no question that the Indians were treated brutally and viciously by whites. There's no question that the blacks were exploited by whites. And there's no question that racism is prevalent. My own research indicates that the closer you get to Indians, the less obvious white racism is in terms of how it applies to blacks. That is, black garrisons near a population of Indians that was perceived to be hostile did not get the same kind of hostile treatment from the whites as other blacks did. So it's a kind of it's a pretty complicated situation.
Mm-hmm. You also explain in a couple of your vignettes how the Indians perceived the discrimination against the black troops by other white troops.
Which do you have in mind in particular?
Well, I was really interested in the one story where surrounded by Indians, the Buffalo soldiers, the Indians that had them surrounded referred to the Buffalo soldiers as white black men.
Ah, the Utes.
Yes.
The Utes with Henry Johnson. Yeah, that is interesting. The Indians were pretty quick sometimes to notice.
Yes, and then the way they perceived the menial tasks that the Buffalo soldiers were asked to do in comparison to the white troops.
I was very surprised at what quick studies they were, to be honest with you. It was quite astonishing, and the Utes were very, very quick to notice the subtleties of the social structure they confronted. That's very true.
But examples of Indians trying to exploit this kind of discrimination to their own advantage, you did not find that.
Except in that one particular case with the taunting of the blacks. But, of course, the blacks didn't understand what the Utes were saying anyway, so it didn't particularly matter.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't find any cases of that. There are cases, of course, in the case of William Wilson's dash for help on the Pine Ridge, the commander's first thought for getting help for his surrounded wagon train was to send Indian scouts to break through the Lakota Ring, and the scouts weren't interested in doing that. and so, of course, Corporal Wilson was the one who had to do it.
Okay. Well, maybe you could expand on that example. That is, with Wilson and a couple of others, if you could give us examples of the feats of valor that actually earned individual Buffalo soldiers their Medal of Honor.
Sure. And the two that I like to talk about the most are Emanuel Stamps and Edward Baker. And the reason why I like to talk about them is because Stance is essentially a first-generation Buffalo soldier who comes into the Army right after the Civil War. And Baker is basically a second-generation Buffalo soldier who was born right about when Stance enlisted. And I use them because they show how the Buffalo soldiers themselves evolved over the short period of time we're talking about. Now, Stance got his medal for actions in 1870 against Kickapoo Indians. And basically, as you may recall at the beginning, we talked about the medal as being for acts of gallantry and other soldier-like qualities. Well, Stance got his medal for distinguished leadership rather than putting himself in harm's way or taking great risks. He led about a half a company-sized patrol in almost a half a dozen significant, sharp, violent actions against Indians in Texas in 1870, and for his leadership in those actions, he earned the Medal of Honor. But the thing about Stance that's interesting is, first of all, that for Stance to lead troops successfully, these troops have to be willing to be led. And so by 1870, you have ex-slaves from just a few years ago who are capable soldiers who are responding well to the leadership of other blacks. Now, the other thing about Stance that's interesting is he's a violent, probably even a terrifying character. He's in fights all the time. He gets busted five times. He bites off the lip of his first sergeant. He spends time in jail. He is a violent, difficult man, and he's ultimately murdered by his own troops. Now, Edward Baker, who got the medal for rescuing a wounded comrade under fire at the San Juan River in Cuba just 100 years ago, could speak Spanish and French. He was a published author in newspapers. He kept his own journal. He was kind of an intellectual and a distinguished man, and so different from his predecessor that I think they illuminate how the Buffalo Soldier evolved over a generation or two on the frontier.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I like to choose those two.
And they're very different. Are there any general traits in the couple of minutes that we have left here? Are there any general traits that fit most of the recipients?
Oh, yeah. And there's two issues here. One is demography and one is character. And in terms of demography, black soldiers in general and black Medal of Honor holders in particular tended to be career soldiers. They tended to be married men, and their longevity in the Army was much more than their white comrades. They saw the Army more as a career, whereas whites passed through, especially immigrants who were acculturated in the Army and went on. As far as character is concerned, this is a very difficult question. What makes a person take extraordinary risks and put himself in harm's way for his fellows and so on? And this is a question that I've not been able to answer, frankly, and I don't know how well military sociologists in general have done with it. But whatever it is, whatever it takes for a man to do that, black soldiers must have had more of it, Dennis, because they had to overcome more in terms of their security in the culture, the lack of opportunity, the racism they confronted, and despite all that, to behave in heroic ways and put themselves at risk. I think these were remarkable human beings.
Okay. Now, Hollywood regularly presents historical portraits, and a recent contribution was Danny Glover's movie on the Buffalo Soldiers.
Yeah.
In the brief minute we have remaining for this interview, does that movie convey an accurate picture of the Buffalo Soldiers?
Well, a pretty accurate picture of the soldiers in the details, but the actual outcome of the movie is kind of a rainbow coalition fantasy. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about respecting the strangeness of the past and understanding the cultural chasm across which soldiers and Indians faced each other. I don't think the movie gives a reasonable depiction of that. I think it's very unrealistic, in fact.
Okay, thank you. As usual, our time flies by in these interviews. I'd like to thank you again for your participation in Talking History.
Thank you very much, Dennis, and our special guest, Dr. Schubert. Our historic site of the week relates to today's topic on the Buffalo Soldiers. The site's in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where, following service in the Civil War, the all-black 10th Cavalry made its headquarters. Their legacy is memorialized in a recently erected monument of a Buffalo soldier on horseback at Fort Leavenworth. In addition to the monument, the Historical Society of Fort Leavenworth maintains a splendid display of Buffalo Soldier photographs, artifacts, and books. We're launching a new segment in our program this week, Previews of Coming Attractions, in which we call your attention to upcoming films or television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else of a related matter that might be of interest to you. We have three attractions to report this week. History isn't all about war and politics. Even mundane topics like dirty laundry figure into the saga of the past. The Smithsonian Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. recently opened America's Clothespins, an exhibit all about laundry. The display runs through June 1998 and showcases clothespin patent models from 1852 to 1887. Features of the exhibit include a variety of toy washing machines, books about clothespins, handcrafted clothespins, people, and illustrations. Also at the Smithsonian this month, a variety of special events in honor of Black History Month. The History Channel is devoting February 23rd through 27th to special programming for Black History Month. The History Channel Classroom will explore African American heritage with pieces such as Buffalo Soldiers, Ships of Slave, The Middle Passage, Freedom's Road, Slavery, and Opposition. For students of pop culture, A&E will explore the strange world of Mark David Chapman, the man who murdered singer John Lennon. American Justice, The John Lennon Assassination, will air February 25th. The hour-long production includes Chapman's life leading up to the assassination, first-hand accounts from officials involved in the murder investigation, and audio-taped prison interviews with Chapman. Check your local listings for broadcast times and dates. Once again, it's time to let the historians have their say, to comment on a contemporary issue from the historian's perspective in what we call our radio op-ed piece of the week. Offering his thoughts this week is George B. Tyndall, Kennan Professor of History Emeritus at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Professor Tyndall's comments are on the recently appointed advisory board of the President's Initiative on Race and an earlier effort of a similar nature. The title of Professor Tyndall's commentary is A Neglected Anniversary.
Last June, President Clinton named Professor John Hope Franklin, a specialist in Southern and Black history, to chair the advisory board of the President's Initiative on Race. Then and since, the media have shown low expectations. 50 years ago, the same thing happened. In 1947, when President Truman named his Committee on Civil Rights, few people expected much from the panel or from the president, a lame duck border state Democrat of Confederate lineage facing a Republican Congress. Yet the committee's report to secure these rights, released 50 years ago last October, was a political bombshell. It called for the elimination of segregation based on race, color, creed, or national origin from American life, and set forth a civil rights agenda for a whole generation. Meanwhile, it helped re-elect Truman in 1948. Over the next 20 years, the towering landmarks of the Civil Rights Revolution were the integration of the armed forces and the civil service, the school segregation decision, and the 1964 Civil Rights Act and 65 Voting Rights Act. By the mid-60s, however, the momentum had run out. The civil rights movement was following the pattern of all revolutionary movements: rise, climax, decline, reaction. That too had happened before. For instance, in the American Revolution, the spirit of 76 inspired gradual emancipation in the northern states and in the Northwest Territory, but by 1800 the momentum had faded. Then in the 1860s, abolition triumphed when the war for the Union turned into a crusade for emancipation. The Reconstruction Amendments ended slavery and affirmed equal protection of the law and the right to vote. But after the overthrow of the Reconstruction governments in the South, reaction led to white supremacy campaigns at the century's end, which limited the black vote and made Jim Crow universal in the South, not uncommon in the North. And each retreat into reaction spurred campaigns of bigotry against aliens and immigrants in our century as before. Now Clinton's initiative is starting in our own century's time of reaction, and despite press notices that the advisory board is just a lot of talk, it is directed to find, develop, and implement solutions to problems in race relations. The greatest issue facing the board is a vestige of slavery itself, continuing economic dependency. That is related to what was slavery's main purpose, a supply of cheap, unskilled labor. The civil rights movement put the focus on legal rights. It did not put food on the table. The advisory board's agenda should move beyond civil rights and focus on dependency, illiteracy, poverty, unemployment, urban decay, slums, things which have no place in a country as wealthy as we claim to be. Franklin and other board members have suggested a special concern with education and opportunity. That would be a start. The timing may not seem right, but the timing did not seem right 50 years ago either. And look what Truman's Committee on Civil Rights started.
That was George Tyndall of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His op-ed piece comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments to offer, questions to raise, or even topics to suggest for future programs, send them to us either by email at talkinghistory, that's all one word, talkinghistory@creighton.edu, or by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Robert Hopkins sitting in for Brian LeBeau.